The Queen's Jewish Link presents the Jewish Living Podcast, the show that examines the many facets of Orthodox Jewish life. Here's your host, Izzo Zwirin.
You know what's hard? Starting a new job. I did it recently. New environment, new roles and responsibilities, new commute. Everything is different, and there's always a lot of pressure to show you belong immediately. Now, imagine that you uprooted your family to move across the country to fill the shoes of a popular predecessor as the head of a large organization. Well, that is what our guest this week has just done.
Hi, I'm Rabbi Uriel Chazan, and I'm the head of Hank West Hempstead Campuses, and it is an honor and pleasure to be here with you, Izzo.
Rabbi Chazan will tell us what it's like to come in as a new principal and what he thinks it takes to be a successful head of school. Rabbi Chazan, thank you for being here as well. First question off the bat, if you can give me a little bit of a background about yourself, just in terms of your educational background. I mean, if you want to give me the whole Rabbi Chazan story, you can, but...
Sure, no. As a fetus, you know, my life was pretty turbulent. I guess I'll start with my educational background, which, was, I guess, pretty normative. I grew up in Los Angeles, went to modern Orthodox Jewish day schools, had actually the privilege of going to the school that I just came from as a child. Went to EULA. And then went to yeshiva in Israel, I was supposed to go to USC in California after yeshiva. That plan changed, much to the dismay of my immigrant parents, who had visions of me becoming a doctor or a lawyer. Tremendous disappointment in my family. I declined my acceptance to USC and instead went to YU. Was in the smicha track with Chacham Ben Chaim Shlita, who is big influence, and Rav Goldwicht. I got to live on the same floor as Rav Goldwicht.
Oh wow.
Yeah. It was like that scene from the movie where, I was living in a frat house, essentially, where just the parties all night long, living next door to Frank Goldman. After YU, I was the first class of, presidential fellows with, under Richard Joel. Mm-hmm. So I decided to stay, work in the university for a year, and then got a job right after getting married, working for the OU. I was very involved in NCSY.
Okay.
And so if you can imagine a guy coming out of college and getting the job of being the national director of summer programs, way over his head. But it did teach me a lot about management. So that was a really, good experience. And then I went back to LA and started working I decided to leave my informal education route and really just kind of start all over. And I was an HR director. So I worked in the business world for about 4 years and really was kind of like the darker time of my life, really not feeling fulfilled. Actually found my way back to YU, to Azrieli. There's a story there about, how that happened, but essentially I got back and was accepted as a YU Teach Fellow.
Okay.
Which gave me a great opportunity.
If you don't mind me asking, how old were you at that time? So you're doing a second career.
I was one of the older candidates in that cohort.
Okay.
I was around, that's a good question. I think it was, I must have been like just about 32.
Okay.
No, that's wrong. I was in my late 20s. That's what it was. I finished around there. Yeah,
early
30s. Exactly.
Okay.
That was like 3 years of three summers. I had just been working as an HR director during 2008 when it was the economic downturn.
Right.
My entire life was firing people. People would come into my office and have the worst day of their lives. And anybody who knows me knows that that is just not my personality. And like, I was devastated. I mean, like, I'm a person that does need people's approval. I would like seek out, like, you know, I want to make sure that people feel comfortable. It's like a very big theme in my life to make sure that people are comfortable, make sure that people are highlighted, spotlighted. And for people to see me coming down the halls and like shudder or look or like move away, like, oh, anybody but that guy. That was a real, like, that's why I say it was a particularly dark time. And I really also got the sense, having fired just every day, fired people, that there weren't opportunities out there, right. Which was incredible. That like the second I decided I'd like to do education as a career, you know, I got offers and job and people wanted my application. As soon as my resume was out, people were sending me applications, you know, all over the country. Which was really just astounding. So right. For me in LA, once I found an opportunity in LA, that was that changed everything.
Okay, so let's fast forward a little bit. And you end up going into education.
Correct.
And you're initially what type of an educator?
So I went right into Jewish education because it was obviously, like, you know, that was my wheelhouse, and that was where I felt I could make the biggest impact, and also where I just got the greatest sipuk nefesh, where, you know, every day you're involved in improving people's lives and bringing them closer to Hashem.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing greater in my life. That's what got me into NCSY. That's what got me into, you know, so many different avenues in my life. So this seemed natural for sure. I was a third grade teacher at Gindi Maimonides Academy, and that was my entree into professional formal education.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was there for about, this was 11 years.
Wow. And eventually?
And then, so last year, I guess I have to back up a little bit before that. Already from like my, again, this was also really different. The fact that already in my second year of teaching, elementary school, I was already in discussions with my head of school and other principals. Oh, you know, you're going to have to join the administration one day. And it was already, it was, you know, they laid it out for me that way. So it was I felt extremely grateful that I had those kinds of mentors in my life who were interested in my growth. That's really something that I'm interested in as well, is kind of like paying that forward to others. I love, you know, mentoring. I love cultivating talent. It was something that started, I think, actually with HR, interestingly, and then now I'm bringing into, you know, formal education. And then I became an administrator. I was an assistant principal for about 3 years, and then last year, a few people started asking me if I was interested in a head of school position, and it just, you know, Hashem really orchestrated it in the middle of COVID to be interviewing. Was a really weird thing. A lot of Zoom interviews. So at some point in the thing, in the whole process, I was like, okay, it's just not going to work out. And it was exactly at that moment that someone said, hey, do you know they're looking at Hank?
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And the rest is history. Now you're the principal of,
right, of the
grades.
It's the early childhood until sixth grade. That's also a unique structure in the country. It's not something that's super common, but definitely, you know, a very unique opportunity and a beautiful opportunity. So,
right,
really incredible.
All right. So we are here to talk specifically about your experience as transitioning into principal, new school,
sure,
new clientele, new state, new coast.
Yeah.
Everything is new in this scenario. My first question to you is based on something that you just said a few moments ago about management. What makes a good manager? Obviously, you told me you're not that interested in being the scary manager. So
right.
So now you have a staff, you have children that are all kind of depending on you and looking up to you.
Right.
What makes, in general and in education, a good manager?
No, I think that's a great question. I look at every experience I've had, every job I've had, and it has really taught me a lot about what, in many cases, management that I did not want. Many things that I saw, the way that I was being treated, the way that I was being spoken to, you know, again, it was, there's this great book that I was reading at the time, because I was really sad a lot in those days, but I read a book called Don't Fire Them, Fire Them Up.
Hmm.
And that was, you know, there's several beautiful points in that book that I took home, but that's really my management style. It's that I'm not looking to, of course, there are times where a manager has to make difficult decisions, has to be, unfortunately, the bad guy, even though for the greater good of the institution, you're the good guy. You always have to be the good guy. But in that moment, I recognize that you're not always going to be able to please everyone.
Right.
However, I think that my role is really the chief, you know, the cheerleading officer. That's how I see it. You know, everybody's got a skill. Everybody's got something gorgeous and beautiful about them. And my goal, really, in my management style is to find that, recognize it. Hopefully people know it about themselves already. But like in my case, I wasn't aware of, you know, what my talents were, my gifts were. I knew, obviously, the ones that were out there, but that my calling was to be an educator. Took a little while to see what was unique about me as an educator. Took a little while to see what I was not good at. Took a little while, you know, that's important too. So really my goal is, once we figure out what it is about you, my job is just to cheer you on and get you going. That's it.
So let's go a little bit back.
Mm-hmm.
You're teaching, you're an assistant principal,
right,
in California.
Right.
Why make this change? It is a massive change. Why even do it? It's uprooting your whole family from California, from LA, in a community that you grew up in, that you're kind of, I'm guessing, embedded in.
Yeah.
You went to the school that you ended up working in,
right,
and you take your family, you move them across the country. That's obviously going to be like a big leap. That's a scary leap.
Yeah.
What goes through your mind when doing that?
I think that, and I've had a little bit of time to think about this, not a ton, but my Rebbe once told me that, you know, if you're ever too comfortable in anything, that should make you a little nervous. And I have adopted that, really. I know that a lot of people are change averse. I'm not someone that's change averse. I really do embrace change. Because in general, I found, especially that, like, you, once you recognize Hashem is running the world, you recognize that, you know, opportunities are really messages, you know, from Hashem. And so for where I was really comfortable and, you know, doing well, Baruch Hashem, but like I could also sense, you know, a little bit of restlessness in me. I didn't want to be doing the same thing again. Mm-hmm. And as soon as that thought crossed my mind, I said, okay, so that's it. We got to make a change. The harder thing that happens, I think when people say the older you get, the harder change is, maybe. I think the harder thing is, how is this going to affect my family? That, I think, is always like a little bit, you have to carry that.
Hmm.
And that's, you know, that's been a challenge, obviously. You know, like it change is difficult for me, change is difficult for my family. But you ultimately, like I said, I think that once I recognized that this was about growth, then it wasn't an issue anymore. I was able to tolerate it a lot more. I just actually saw a beautiful vort from Rav Elimelech Biderman, who said that Noach, this week's Parsha, whenever you're listening to this.
we're recording this right at Matzah Shabbos, Parsha's Noach.
Right. But so maybe it's Pesach when you're listening to this. But anyway, we're still talking about Noach here. So when Noach was in the Teva, his name is Noach. He's pleasant. He's calm. He's easygoing. He's calm on the boat. How can you be calm while the waters are raging around you, while the world is being destroyed around you, the tumult of it all? And his answer, which I thought was just brilliant, is that because he knows that this is going to be for the good.
Right.
You can tolerate any kind of, like, if you know that the turbulence on the plane is really nothing, that, like, you're going to land, everything's going to be fine, then the turbulence, kind of look at it a little differently. I'm saying that because I happen to have a tremendous fear of turbulence. So, like, I have to get in my head all the time when I'm on a plane. But that's what I think about. Like, oh, I'm not going to touch down, everything's fine. So, you know, this isn't, you know, some steel cage barreling towards, you know, oblivion for me. That this is just, you know, I'm going to be fine. Hashem, the reason I'm in this turbulence is because tremendous growth is coming out of this.
Exactly. That's very, it's a very well thought out message. When you're switching careers, now you switched careers
a few times, yeah.
And now you're switching a major change in job.
Right.
Right. And you're probably the exact right person to talk to this about. You did the reverse of that because I started in education, I left.
Ah.
And now I'm in more of a corporate environment right. versus the other way.
By the way, I think that, I live in education all day, but I really do believe we're all in education just by the fact that we are Jewish people who have a set of values that really are forward thinking about, like, again, I keep saying growth, but that I think any parent is in education, anybody who interacts with other people, like, I guess unless you're stuck in front of a screen all day, but like, to me, I really do believe we're all about sharing each other's experiences that leads to growth in other people. We're all in education.
Maybe we are. Yeah. Some of us get paid
formal,
for it.
Formal, though. Yeah, we get paid for it. That's right. That's right. That's what I said. I said, I want to get paid for this.
So just for my listeners out there that might have changed careers or made a huge change in jobs within the same field, is there a difference between doing it in education than it is in other fields, or are they about the same?
The difference in education, I think it's mostly the same, you know, because moving your family across the country is tumultuous. It's a daunting task. But in education, you know, it's a very nurturing environment. Again, by just the nature of the field, you're going to be dealing with teachers. Teachers are people that care. Teachers are people that inspire change and inspire growth. To me, if it was in another field, I think I probably would be a little more nervous. Like, what, you know, I think you always worry about your work environment. I think I worry a little less about that. I think you always worry about what the corporate structure is like and what, you know, culture does matter. So yeah, I definitely think those things are still like a worry regardless of what field you're in. But in education, in a sense, you know, since we're all, there's a higher calling, I think, and a more global view of what the mission is. And so when you have that, maybe, at least for me, I can only speak for myself, I think that there's a lot of built in that I don't need to think about. There's a lot of questions I don't need to ask because I'm making a switch within a field that you know, is values-based and aligns with who I am.
Okay, so the reason that we actually invited you on, it's nice that we're getting to know about the inner workings of Rabbi Chazan's mind, but we generally try to make these episodes practical and ways that other people can grab into it. Now, the people who live in West Hempstead out there are going to want to know all about their new principal that they have here. A lot of listeners are from West Hempstead and they hear these shows, and that's great for them, but there's a much more that are outside of West Hempstead that don't necessarily listen to Hank. So the reason that we asked you to come in is that even though you're in Hank, you probably have a lot to say now, hopefully, about what it's like to take over a school. Other people out there send their kids to schools. They might have gone through a change in principal, a change in the administration, or they're going to in the future. Not all, like any other profession, principals don't just stay there forever.
Right.
Like you get new teachers, new educators, just like in any other job. So we wanted to gear this conversation towards what it's like to come in and take over a new school, both from a perspective of the educator, and then if you can do a reverse and look at it from the other side, from the perspective of the parents. So the first question that I have for you in this regard is, what is the differences, or what are the differences, between the school that you're in now, Hank, and the school that you came from?
Well, so it's actually, again,
or similarities. I should say that also.
Similarities, differences. I got the question. I have to say it's a tremendous Yad Hashem, and you can't miss that a lot in life. It wasn't this school that I was interviewing for, that school that I was interviewing for. It ended up with Hank. Hank and Maimonides are pretty closely aligned. You know, the parent body has some differences. You know, obviously the locations are different. You know, and they're also at different points in their development. The schools are. But similarities, their values are very similar in terms of, you know, what we say about Hank a lot, what was told to me when I was interviewing. You know, it's a place that focuses on academics, on meeting the child where they are. A place that exudes warmth that is in the hallways, in the classrooms, and within the student body. You see it in those moments, those gorgeous moments where, you know, people are running to see their parents at the end of the day, but there's also that same smile where the kids are running towards the school, you know, in the morning. I get to see both because I kind of stand right at the door of both right. of those scenes. And we would see that, you know, at Maimonides as well. You know, when a place feels like home, then, you know, I think maybe this harkens back to that other question you were asking. You know, I don't necessarily worry so much about, you know, the corporate structure or like what are the differences in, you know, the buildings or things like that, because the lifeblood of these two institutions are very much aligned. You know, so in terms of the differences, you know, if that's the next part of the question, then I would say that the school that I'm coming from, you know, it's their trajectory, their growth. I think I see a lot of things that I saw 10 years ago in Maimonides that are, you know, here and ready for that kind of growth mm-hmm. here. And in many ways, Hank is, you know, ahead of Maimonides, but in many ways, you know, I can see those same kind of things that are like ready for growth. And that's wildly exciting to have gone through it, you know, on another building, another school, another institution, another community, and to see the potential for it here is just, it's wildly exciting.
And it's interesting because with that, you've had experience already going through those changes.
Yeah.
And you know exactly. things that work, you know things that don't work. Yeah. You can probably apply those
exactly,
things.
Exactly, exactly. Like there's a lot of, you know, okay, so we know this program doesn't work, or we saw how if we could do it differently in LA, we would have done it this way. So it's great. Now I can like just take best practices and kind right. of move forward. One part of your question, I think it's impossible not to bring up that taking over anything or being in education today, you know, COVID has had a massive impact on education. I think the tired and common trope at this point is to talk about how difficult it is, you right. know, and I think we all know, you know, that old tune. Some of the things that just became more and more apparent is how, you know, families struggled, kids are struggling, and, you know, that means that there's a huge opportunity here for something, a return to foundations, a return to basics. What do I mean by that? One of my inspirations, one of the, you know, like a mentor that I have that really I try to follow is Rabbi Kalish, Rabbi Daniel Kalish. And he's a leader of the yeshiva in Waterbury, Connecticut. And his constant refrain is relationships and connections. And I think that students now are more thirsty than ever for real, authentic connection. And I know that people worry about this exposure to, you know, so many devices because now kids were stuck at home, they were quarantined, or now everything became reliant on technology. I think the more we head into technology dependence, the more the thirst for real, authentic human connection comes to the front. You see that when, like, you make a joke and a kid responds, and now, you know, later on they're looking for you in the hallway, they want... they're looking for connection. And that's why, to me, I say this all the time. I try to model this. I talk to the teachers all the time. Find that thing about the kid. Find the thing that they need. And start with the basics. Hey, I know that you guys had hockey tryouts. How did that go? You know, your dad, how's he doing? I heard that, you know, this whatever challenge there was.
Right.
That care, that extra care, today is more necessary than ever. I don't want to say that it's broken, but, you know, kids are facing more challenges than I think they've ever had. And I sometimes really think, like, wow, it is harder to be a kid in many ways now than it was when I don't feel like I was, I'm so far away from it, but you know,
nobody does.
Yeah. I'm looking at, like, you know, even what kids were like 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, it is, we have greater challenges, and kids are coming to school. You see that there's underlying pain sometimes, you know. I think that school is a massive influence on a child's life, and a teacher is a massive influence. There's a huge opportunity for connection, and that's why I think when we hire teachers, we need to look for people to just have a joy of life, you know, a hope. Give kids hope. Give kids a place where they can come back and continue and teach them how to connect. Teach them that people are fascinating, that there's wonderful things about each person. A story that I think about all the time, something that I love as an educator that I think about a lot. We haven't touched on it yet, but I'm a big music guy. I'm really into singing, performing. I love musical instruments. I love even just hearing about music, and I see what music, I think we need more music in our lives. I think that when you see kids dancing with music, it you see them light up. It has an amazing power, Jewish music specifically. So there's a story about Yitzhak Perlman.
The violinist.
Yeah, the world-class violinist. He was playing towards the end of his life. You know, he was on crutches, and he was, you know, struggling to get out onto the stage to perform. He was sitting, of course, first chair violin, and you know, they're performing a complicated piece, a Rachmaninoff, very like animated, you know, intense kind of music piece, and it's a symphony. It's a symphony. It's so complicated that he's a brilliant performer, and it's a famous story. I think he was in, I'm not sure, it was somewhere in Europe. He's performing, and in the middle of his performance, there's a loud, audible snap. There's one of his strings, I think it was his third string, popped in the middle of a performance. Things like that happen. And if you're not first chair violin and you're not responsible to compose, like, you know, the major themes of these symphonies, okay, right? Someone, you'll run off stage, you'll grab a replacement and get back. And, you know, for all intents and purposes, the audience won't be the wiser. But when you're Yitzhak Perlman and your third string breaks in the middle of a solo,
you're not running off the stage so fast.
Correct. He's got the crutches. He's not going to like lumber back there. What's he going to do?
Yeah.
We're going to stop the performance. This guy's too important, you know? But no, he waves off any kind of help. And he continues to perform the entire... You and I both know no one's going to perform a symphony on three strings. It's just not possible. It's not possible. And the mathematical calculations that he has to make, transposing his E string to... where is he going to play this now? He has to do all of these calculations in real time. It's just another demonstration of his genius. And sure enough, when that last note resonates throughout the hall, everybody's breathless. They stand up, give him a standing ovation. I don't know how, I think God blesses people in moments like this to say the right thing. But at the end, he said one sentence, and you know, he wasn't even talking about the incident, really. He wasn't talking about a violin. He said, they asked him, how were you able to do it? And his answer was, we all have to make music with whatever we have. And that's what I mean. I think that, like, we are all missing something in some ways. And sometimes our emphasis on perfection, our emphasis on, you know, achievement of a certain kind can really hurt and break children, you know, and break people, adults too. So you don't have that third, you only have two strings, let's say. Your violin doesn't even work. You need to do beatboxing on this thing. You need to, like, you know, whatever. The point is that our job is to highlight that thing, make that glow, make that shine. And the only way that I know how to do that is really through connection, you know, and relationships, making sure that I know what's great about you, you know what's great about me, and then we start to build trust and rapport. So, Yeah, that's something that really kind of I think about a lot, you know.
So you mentioned Rabbi Kalish from Waterbury. It's funny you mentioned it, and I'll tell you a story that's the exact thing that you're talking about.
Yeah.
When I was in 12th grade, I wasn't sure that I was going to spend a year in Israel. I ended up doing it, but at one point I was thinking about going to learn in Waterbury.
Ooh.
That was a potential thing. So I went to Waterbury for a Shabbos.
Okay.
I met Rabbi Kalish on Friday night at an oneg in his house.
Right.
That was the first time I ever met him.
Right.
And I spoke to him for approximately 45 seconds.
Right.
Told him my name and just said, oh, I'm just here to check out the yeshiva. Just looking around for a Shabbos. Nice to meet you. Great. Next day at Shacharis, or after davening, he goes, oh, Yisrael is my real name.
Yeah,
for all my listeners. Yisrael, how did things go last night? How was your stay? How'd you sleep? How'd you like davening this morning? Like, wait, you remember my name? When I ask people on their name.
Right.
I'm not guaranteed to remember it the next time I see them, unless they have some very unusual name.
Right.
Yisrael is not super unusual.
Right.
But the fact that he like remembered my name the first time, only talked to him once for 45 seconds.
Right.
And then he remembered my name. And the next time he saw me, he was able like to say it. And I asked somebody about it. He's like, that's Rabbi Kalish. The explanation I got, he's like, when you ask somebody your name, their name, you're starting a conversation.
Right.
When he asks you your name, he's earnestly trying to find that information. He's trying to make that connection that you spoke about.
Right.
It's the same thing that you, if you're at work and you ask your coworker a question, you ask them and they give you the answer and you got that information. Now that's in your head. You have to go and do something with that information. That's what he's doing. He's like, oh, I have that information in my head now. This person likes that. They don't like this. Now I have that information. So I can make that connection. It's not just being polite.
Right.
It's the idea of really wanting to know something about somebody else, and that's what you're really talking about.
It's a great point. He is, in my mind, a gadol of many proportions, but he's a gadol of human connection.
Mm-hmm.
Like his IQ for relationships is like off the charts, and I think it's just something that we can all. It's not. It's like you said. It's not like he is someone that is looking to do it. Oh, how can I best? You know, what can I do with this information? No, he's genuinely interested in you. Genuinely interested in connecting with you. I think that is the essence boiled down of what a teacher is.
So I asked you earlier about the differences and similarities between your current school and your school you came from.
Sure.
I'm going to talk a little bit about the communities.
Yeah.
I don't need to ask you the differences and similarities. I don't want to get anybody in trouble.
Yeah.
But what I want to know is how the community that you're in now in Long Island, in Nassau County, has responded to you. And have there been challenges in those regards or surprises, pleasant surprises? What has your experience been like with the community?
Right. I people are going to think that I'm saying this like politically. So I hope that you can't see my face, but I'm smiling across ear to ear right now. I'll start by saying it was as advertised, which I think is shocking because what was advertised about the West Hempstead, Long Island in general, but like what was advertised about West Hempstead, Oceanside, these communities was that it was a place where, you know, you're going to feel connected to the community. People are going to invite you over and you're just going to be, it's off to the races once you land. And truth in advertising is super hard to find anywhere, but I just thought, you know, people are just exaggerating because they really want you to come and they want you to feel good and get excited. But like, you know, ultimately there's a moment where you've unpacked and now like it's quiet, you know, and like you really, it's on you to make these connections. I don't know. This is like this is our third month here in Nassau County. We haven't been a Shabbos without an invitation.
Wow.
And the first 4 weeks, Izzo, people were coming over to the house and knocking on the door and saying hello, like we were in like some Twilight episode or like in Pleasantville. I could not believe it. There's like always this cynical part of your mind that's like, oh, there's some ulterior motive. I see these people in the streets. I see them, you know, at Dunkin' Donuts. Another massive surprise for me, by the way. Dunkin' Donuts, did not expect that to be as awesome as it is. I thought we had great coffee in LA. So just for people coming around and you see like over and over, there's like a genuine interest in making connection and having people over, growing families together. You see people like-minded values living in the same neighborhood. It does something. LA is gorgeous. It's incredible. The community, I mean, I have lifelong relationships there. But it's just so big. It's so big. It's so spread out. There's something I never really thought about. And I grew up, I guess you would say, quote unquote, in the like smaller part or like the neighborhoody type part of LA. I grew up in the Valley.
You could say that. People know the sections of LA.
Yeah. I grew up in the Valley. So like I always had that, you know, chip on my shoulder. I always loved small communities. I always loved that. But, you know, the Valley is unbelievably spread out and, you know, you don't know your neighbors so much. And here, the neighbors are seeking you out. Where best moment, you want to know, that really was like crystallized West Hempstead and this whole thing. We're in our sukkah, and it's like second night of Sukkot. And we're just like finishing the soup or whatever. And someone's screaming from across, you know, behind our backyard into the other neighbor, and they're screaming, "We are sukkah number one, number one, number one. We are sukkah number one. Where is number two?" We look around the table like, "Oh my gosh, I think we're sukkah number two." We started screaming, "We're sukkah number two, number two." And everyone's laughing and clapping. And it's like, "Oh my gosh, what a moment. This is where we are." For that to happen.
I grew up in a communal drive, like in Queens, where so everybody listens, like, There would be times when like different sukkahs would start singing Zmiros and then other sukkahs would join them.
Right.
It would be that type of thing.
That's gorgeous.
Yeah.
That's gorgeous. So that's not something I'm super familiar with. And for that to happen in LA, I would need some kind of incredibly powerful amplification system. It just, you know, I would get arrested.
Hard to get on the second
get
round of sukkahs
for
too.
Some kind of noise ordinance violation for sure.
Let's move into some of the actual, you know, day-to-day runnings of this school. First question I have for you in that is a two-parter. Again, I like my two-part questions.
Yeah.
Something that you brought in with you that you're like, I want to implement this, and something that you came in and you saw, you never thought of that type of a thing that you saw, that's really nice, and I want to keep that and either keep it as is or make it stronger. So you can take either
I'll
one
start,
of those parts.
I'll start with what I loved the second I got into the school. So first of all, it's emblazoned on our logo, Chanoch Lenar Al Pi Darko. A lot of schools say that they meet students where they are. And it's kind of like, I won't call it like a dirty secret, but there's very, very different levels of success, you know, based on, you know, the institution, what actual, you know, what the real focus, how much of a focus that is in every institution. I was really surprised. And again, LA, you know, we have the LAUSD, you know, which is a devastation. It's impossible to get funding. It's impossible to get services. You know, there's like a culture of like, you have to almost like really exaggerate how bad a situation is in order to get qualified for like any kind of services. And here in New York, right away, that was like a tremendous bracha. And that Hank was so well attuned to what each student needed and how the student support team was so well, like fine-tuned about what, oh, so for this one, we're providing these services. They have this testing, they have that, they have this, they have, you know, here we're providing this service for that student. Here's the report about the accommodations, and here's how we're meeting those accommodations. I mean, for my educational philosophy, where I really do want to meet children where they are and make people feel comfortable, this was a tremendous blessing to come.
Is it also a little like daunting? Like, whoa, this is a lot of information, or is this?
Oh, for sure. But I don't get nervous like that, because to me, all of that information is like a roadmap to how we can do it. I always get nervous when we don't know what's going on. Like, to me, that's much more. And sometimes there are actual impediments to getting the information we need about what that child needs and what's going on. How come, you know, this is so hard? How come that's not working? And I think there's a lot less stigma here about getting services, getting help. Forget about even if it's like so formalized and district and you know, a formal kind of plan. I just saw a culture that embraced the differences in each person and didn't look at it like, okay, how are we going to get this kid to conform to what we need? I saw this child needs something. We need to do more to help them where they are. And that, I loved. And credit to Rabbi Sadiq, the previous person who was sitting in this position, and obviously really the people who founded the school with this in mind. So really, that was a tremendous blessing. One thing that I'm just trying to bring from, you know, LA, and something I'm bringing just, you know, from my school, was this culture of, you know, like I said, Jewish music and just an excitement. I don't want to call it like a camp feel, but
why not?
There is, because I don't know. I don't want anyone to look at to read like other things into it. I'm going to be very specific about what I love about camp. There's something that happens when you are, you know, swimming in excitement, when you're swimming in, like, you never know, like, just a little bit of like surprise, like, you never know what's he going to do next, if I come into class, there could be a surprise celebration for, you know, the fact that we just finished a page of Mishnah, or maybe we just finished a Sefer in Navi, or maybe we finally finished this unit in math, and now there's going to be this tremendous set. We don't know. The announcements through the school, you know, the speaker, I probably abused that a little too much, I'm going to be honest, but, you know, all of a sudden we're hearing music through the loudspeaker. What's going on? Are we screaming about someone's birthday? Are we screaming, like, what are we screaming about right now? So one thing I really wanted to bring that I saw wasn't there was the Shabbat assembly.
Mm.
And it is, to me, a place where school culture kind of lives and kind of is the epicenter of like these vibrations that kind of go out throughout the school, throughout the week. Shabbat assembly, for those who are uninitiated, is this moment where the half the school, because we don't have enough space really yet for an indoor kind of situation where the entire school can be together, but like half the school in two time slots will get together, will sing Shabbat songs, but with like live music, and it's bumping in there.
That's awesome. It is
like a simcha hall in that place. Then we're telling stories. We're highlighting Mido Tovot Awards. I've asked all the teachers to really like zoom in when you see a student do something that it's very, very, what I call like just, that's a Hank moment.
Mm.
Like where you see a kid doing a Hank thing. What's a Hank thing? Well, this kid is on the wrong page in Tefillah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know, nobody's really noticing, but one kid does, and he goes over and shows him the right page. That's a Hank moment. Kid doesn't have snack. Somebody comes over, gives them snack. Kid seems lost, new to the school. Two or three kids are saying, what's your next class? I'll show you where it is. That's the kind of thing that we're talking about in front of the whole school. And we're saying, and we're awesome. Bringing those kids up, and we're celebrating them, and we're dancing. So that's a culture builder for me. And also selfishly, I just have this like problem that if I'm not singing or playing music in a little while, so this kind of satisfies a very personal problem that I have.
So, on the same note, what is something that you might want to change or implement that you just haven't been able to? I mean, you've been here for what, 2 months already?
Yeah.
So how dare you not be able to throw everything in there?
I appreciate that, Izzo. It's been 3 months, and what are you doing?
Come on, like, get a move
on. Why haven't you gotten?
I'm not talking about something that like. All right, we're going to get to it. Oh, I haven't been able to implement because it's not Hanukkah yet, and it's a Hanukkah thing. I'm talking about something that you're like, I wanted to do this, but I was told, or we're not there yet type of a thing that maybe in a couple of years down the road you might be able to think about doing.
Right. I haven't had that yet.
Oh, wow.
And it's obviously it's early days, but the truth is already in like my interviews, a lot of the things that I spoke about when I was talking about the vision, the mission of the school, you know, the tenets of this vision that I'm trying to develop, and really some of the culture things, everybody's been incredibly supportive. All of the people, you know, are behind, you know, this vision, and we're really in a place now where I don't think that there's anything that's going to be really in our way except for ourselves. You know, like, it's really a limit on our own imagination and our limit on our own possibility of what could happen. I think that, to me, we have an incredible team of people. We're bringing more people in. We have visions for, you know, a school culture that is alive and vibrant, where kids feel comfortable. I told you before the beginning of this thing, making people comfortable is a big theme in my life. I don't think a kid can be successful. I don't think a teacher can be successful if they feel uncomfortable, if there's some kind of thing going on, you know, that is being unaddressed. So I have to take I have to give a ton of credit to Mrs. Barbara Deutsch, you know, who's the associate principal, and Mrs. Michal Wasser, who's just, again, these are just phenomenal people with tremendous vision for where the school can go. Mm-hmm. I feel very confident about the direction that we're headed in. And I think that once people hear about it, once people know about it, once the word gets out, and I think it's going to start with our teachers. They're the lifeblood of our institution. And we have incredible, phenomenal teachers. And the more I get to know them, the more that seems to be true. Like, the more and more you see that, wow, somebody with this much experience is still rocking in a classroom and using all that experience, and kids are comfortable, they're happy. You walk into a classroom, like, kids are excited to be in that class. They want to connect with their teachers. To me, again, there really cannot be a more exciting time to be in this school. There cannot be a more exciting time. And with all the challenges that kids are going through, I don't see any work that's more important than what we're doing.
That's phenomenal. As someone who's married to a Hank alum and whose father-in-law was also a Hank alum,
wow,
I'm sure they love hearing the fact that, like, oh, now's the best time. Yeah. Well, I was there for 8 years. What happened when I was there?
You're so right. And I'll tell you, that's like another refrain that I keep hearing over and over again. As soon as people know what I do, they want to show me their connection
right
to Hank. What you just did happens to me, you know, in IND, the local supermarket happens to me, you know, on Hempstead Avenue. It's happening to me, you
which
know,
is the local thoroughfare for anybody who doesn't know West Hempstead geography.
I'm getting really local, guys. really local. You know, they want to tell you the connection they have to the school. They want to tell you about how, you know, their great grandfather started the school and this and that. It's amazing. Amazing. So to me, I'm super respectful and of the past and the history. It just enriches everything that we're doing.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one last question, and then we'll have a little bit of a wrap up. But for those out there that might have aspirations of becoming a principal, for those out there who are now looking to hire a new principal, what advice do you have for those? Those are two very separate categories, by the way.
Yeah.
For those types of people, somebody who may want to ascend to the leadership, and for somebody who's looking to maybe bring somebody in.
Izzo, let's start first with the person who is not in education that should be.
Mm.
That's a bigger problem, I think, first. You know, yeah, I would love to talk about how many incredible people out there that could be heads of schools that are not. But I think we have a much bigger problem just making sure that people understand that you can be successful in education. And I'm not saying that everybody can be a teacher, which contradicts what I said at the beginning. Everybody is a teacher. I do believe everybody is a teacher. But not everybody can do it like all day, all the time. There's an art to it and a science to it. The science can be taught. You know, how do we create units? How do we create, you know, great triggers for a class? How do we make ideas stick? Okay, no problem. But there are people out there who have a calling and want this to be like this. This is not a career, it's a calling. And for many reasons, they're ignoring that calling. And again, at every opportunity I have, and I've never really had, you know, maybe the opportunity like this, but I would just start with this answer. I would feel it wouldn't be me if I didn't start by saying, don't ignore that calling if you have it. If you have it, if you have any inkling that this is something for you, you have to pursue it. Let others tell you that, no, this is not it, you know, for you. Fine. But don't ignore it if you have it, because we need more talent in education. We need more people going into this. We need this to become the destination for these talented individuals, because we need you. Our people need you. Now to get to your question about, you know, who should go in, like what type of person should think about, is that what the question was?
What type of person should think about going in, if they want to become a principal, even if they want to become an educator, you can go either way.
Right. So I think that, you know, it's interesting there. In some cases, sometimes a person who is, you know, really driven to do something, that's an incredible thing. So for those, I don't think they need this advice. So, you know, let's just say that someone who's driven to be an institutional leader and has the right stuff will go far. I think maybe the question is really addressing, you know, those who are reticent, nervous about it. I remember looking at my head of school and the types of things that, you know, they had to deal with. And I would say to myself, oh, I never want that job. Like that, that does not look interesting, exciting, or whatever.
I call that the Gabay effect.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Gabay is the job that I look at it in a show. I'm like, nope.
Yeah.
Why would anybody ever want to do that? For all those Gabayim out there, I'm very, very mega props.
Let's reiterate that blessing that we make every Shabbat about how awesome you are.
Yes. Most underappreciated position in Judaism, I think.
Yeah. Look, I'll tell you, you should not go into this job if you're looking for a lot of like accolades, if you think that it's like the prestige of it, you know, because I look at this as like you really are the chief servant of the institution. And again, that sounds like very technical, but I really mean it in its glorified way, which is you have the privilege to serve. If you're looking to affect change outside of the four walls of your classroom, and you've already seen what you're able to accomplish in the classroom, and that's exciting to you. You see how your particular touch or your brand, your vision, the way that people seem to respond to you, the way that parents are responding to you, and what the stories they share about, you know, something you said, something that you created, that lesson really left an impact, and we're still talking about it today. If that's exciting to you, oh man, buckle up, because the administration is where you affect a community. I mean, you affect an entire school. I mean, that is wildly exciting. But again, it's not for everyone. I wouldn't say, oh, this is an adventure. I guess if you're, you know, an accountant, being a partner in the firm or something is like the inevitable. That's you have to strive for that. I don't think that's the case in education. You know, the teacher's end goal, I don't think is, you know, administration, and I think that's a good reason, because there are people who have like
some people who are very good educators that might not necessarily be cut out for
administration. Yeah, I'll tell you, if you're really a good educator, though, I don't see how you couldn't have a great impact in administration. But what I really mean to say is that it's a false comparison that some people make, like, oh, they're just a classroom teacher. That whoever says that does not understand the nature of what we're doing at all. Some have this calling of, you know what, I think I can actually influence the entire institution, that something that I'm doing, you know, could be beneficial for others. You have to be the type that like loves teaching teachers, because I loved getting taught by other teachers. Yeah. I loved it. So to me, it was natural. It was something that I wanted to pursue. But if you're making an impact in the classroom, oh my goodness, that's where we need, like I said at the beginning, we're desperate for people to follow their calling and to continue what they're doing.
So I'm going
to
change my second part of the question, because that didn't make any sense, because my second part of the question was, people looking for principals, but that you weren't in that position. I'm going to change that to somebody who is now becoming a head of school, somebody out there who may in the future become, what are some things that you advise, like once they get the job, once they get that position, some things that they should do initially right off the bat to make sure that they're on the right track?
Yeah. I'm going to say this with all of the arrogance that comes with answering such a question, having sat in the job for 3 months.
Well, that's why I'm asking. It's very fresh in your mind at this point.
I'll tell you, to me, there, I could not at all do anything without the mentorship that I'm getting, without the guidance that I'm getting, without the support of, you know, everybody that cares about this institution, you know, the board members, the community members, the leaders. So I think that the best advice I got was really just be a very considerate and active listener. And what that meant to me was listen to as many voices as you can. You know, almost seek out the voices that, you know, don't agree with you and engage them. And find out what it is, maybe what's that insight that I'm missing? What's that nugget about, you know, what makes Hank so unique that I haven't heard? Or, you know, because to me, there's no one person has the absolute truth about this. You know, what's right. going to happen? So for sure, you know, I rely on the support I'm getting a lot. And really, my goal is to make sure that I'm just, again, cheerleading the people who are around me and being there to service the people that really make the school work. That's the, I think that's my view. That's what I'm starting with. You know, bring me on in a year, Izzo, and I'll tell you I'll tell you how different things are.
We could do it again. Follow up 1 year from now. Now, I usually have a set of questions that I ask specifically to musicians.
Yeah.
Two of them aren't going to be relevant to you.
Yeah.
But I want to ask you one of those questions, seeing how into music you are. I want to know if you have a recommendation for a song or an album that exists out there that doesn't get the credit that it might deserve.
That's such a good question.
That you think that people should just, hey, go take a listen to this album or take a listen to this question. Listen to the song.
Sorry. Oof. Okay. So I'm excited to answer this question, but I'm like, my mind is in too many places. Let me start with Jewish. the first Shel Shalit album deserves another round.
Wow.
On your
That's
playlist.
The one with S.I.N.I. on it.
Yes.
Actually, my favorite song on there, I was literally talking to somebody about it today to see if I could do it for, if I could use it for a Kedusha, which is Ekra.
Oh my gosh, Israel, I was about to say Ekra.
I was literally talking to somebody today about that in Shul.
Right. There's a problem that happened, you know, with me in that album. It's that my yeshiva used it to wake us up in the morning. So I have horrible associations with that first track. That first track, Miha Ish really sends me into night terrors. But it's a gorgeous album and the harmonies are insane. And they also, you know, here's why. I always give a lot of credit to any musician who finds like a very esoteric pasuk and like turns it into a song, and you're like, I don't even know where that song comes from. And then all of a sudden you're davening on Yom Kippur and you're like, whoa, dude, you were on Yom Kippur, you were fasting, and you were like, this could be a song. That's incredible. So yeah, so no, great question. I think that deserves another turn. I'm getting into like, I don't know, I'm going to sound very old right now, but like I'm getting into diaspora a lot, like kind of like old stuff that like man, they were living in disco and they were making it cool, you know,
right?
And it's still cool, you know, if you give it a try. Somebody new contemporary, I love Hanan Ben Ari. I think that dude understands music, and he's making a lot of Jewish music that can be stale and like recycled. He's making it real fresh.
Wow.
So he deserves a listen.
All right. You got everybody at home. You have your homework. You have Shalas 1,
Diaspora.
The original Diaspora.
Yeah.
and Hanan Ben Ari.
Yeah, yeah, you can't go wrong. That, amazing. I mean, if you're working out or you're doing whatever, you're going to be in good hands.
All right. Before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for having me on this podcast. This was an amazing experience. I'm grateful that, you know, I'm grateful to Hashem for this opportunity that my family has had. We've been welcomed so beautifully. My colleagues, my cohort. I'll just leave with this one idea that they discovered recently. This is something that Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson brought out. Some scientists in Israel were digging around, you know, Masada, and they unearthed some 1,500-year-old seeds, date palm. Sorry, maybe it was even older than that. Date palm seeds, and they planted, they regenerated them, replanted them, and were able to grow a ancient palm tree in Israel.
Wow.
And it's very complicated because, you know, if it's a male or a female palm tree, it's not going to give you dates. So like they're geniuses out there. They figured it out. And he shared the moment that they were able to grow those dates and make sure they were edible. And you see the crew get together around, I guess, the lead researcher who picks up a date, makes a bracha, borei pri ha'etz, and then makes a shachianu on that. I think that, you know, we have an opportunity. That what that made me think about was the fact that we have an opportunity in our lives to make the old completely new again. And a lot of things that have been laying there dormant, there's, you know, we have to always consider best practices. We have to look at data and research and everything else. All of that's super important to running our institutions. But there are some things that are out there already that have been laying dormant for a while. And it's not just about education. It's about kids. It's about discovering potential in people. The date palm is interesting because a date palm is only, this is interesting. I come from LA. We used to go to Palm Springs. And in Palm Springs, you know, there's not much to do out there. But you can take a tour of a palm tree nursery. That's exciting. They
get a lulav.
Yeah, totally. You'll learn something totally. It's like it seems like a useless fact. A palm tree that grows in isolation from other palm trees, its dates are poisonous. You can't eat them. The sweetest dates you can eat are the ones that are grown in a grove. That's because the roots underneath get to intermingle with the other palm trees. And then we have this pasuk, tzaddik hatamar yifrach, right? A tzaddik only flourishes like a date. And again, to me, this is what I'll leave you with. This is really like what I was driving towards. We all have a calling. We all have a gift. We all have something that makes us unique. A teacher is specialized at bringing that out. Once we have that, we cannot ignore it. We have to cheer it. We have to nurture it. We have to cultivate it through relationships, through connection. And once we figure it out, wow, what a happy day. What a happy day that is. I think that's our goal. That's our calling.
I like how you brought that back to Katamar Yifrach with diaspora. It was very nice.
Yeah, you got me.
Very good. Rabbi Uriel Chazan, thank you so much for joining me this week.
An absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, everyone.
My thanks to Rabbi Uriel Chazan for joining me this week. If you're interested in some other Jewish education-related content, you can check out Episode 7, Homeschooling with Yael Hanover, who, in some ways, is the principal of her own school. Or if you want to take a stroll down memory lane to find out how schools were thinking about COVID at its beginning, you can hear Rabbi Chazan's predecessor, Rabbi Yaakov Sadig, in Episode 27, Educating During a Pandemic. Until next time, Kol Tov.
The Jewish Living Podcast is produced by Sreli Pikus. Our theme song is The Band by A.B. Rottenberg. Follow us on Facebook at The Jewish Living Podcast and on Twitter and Instagram at Jewish_living. You can also email the show at jewishlivingpodcast@gmail.com. The Jewish Living Podcast is recorded in conjunction with the Queens Jewish Link.